3, 2, 1.
Well, good evening, everybody. This is Hunt Tooley, and this is session number 7 of the World War I course at the Mises Academy. And our course, of course, is World War I, Crucible of the Age of Statism. And here we worked our way down to number 7, Titanic Wars, 1917 and 1918, and we're going to talk about a whole variety of things tonight, all of which are related to our main themes. I mean, our main theme of just figuring out what the course of the war was, so we know more about how to interpret actions that took place during it. But also the themes of collectivism, of the individual in this war, of the dehumanizing aspects of the war, and so forth. So without further ado, let's plunge into our topic and see what we've got. I wanted to start with this, with my title, The Titanic Wars. It comes from a Wilfred Owen poem. Wilfred Owen was a young man who, like so many British young men, signed up with great enthusiasm and talked about how sweet it would be to die in some battlefield somewhere. But he soon ceased to think that and was both sick and wounded, shell-shocked. He had a horrific experience on the front. And this process of experience, of understanding, he went to a mental institution for officers named Craig Lockhart, and there he came in contact with the writings of Siegfried Sassoon, about whom more a bit later. And, well, long story short, he became the greatest poet of the war. And this title comes from one of his greatest poems. Here it is. It seemed that out of battle I escaped down some profound tunnel, scooped through granite, which flames, I can't quite read his handwriting, which flames had groined. Yet also there encumbered sleepers groaned. And if we move on down, we'll find the words, the Titanic Wars in his poem. So that's our subject. And I think the war became in 1917, as I mentioned last week, the historian Albrecht Carrier, an Italian historian, said that this year, the 1917, is the year that the deeper forces broke through. We talked a lot about that week, that last week, in terms of American intervention, in terms of the two revolutions in Russia. But there's more to say about it. So this week we want to talk about the titanic and horrific nature of this war from some other angles. And so we'll take Wilfred Owen and depart from there, but we'll come back to him in just a little bit. So we'll talk about the course of the war and some aspects, actually, of the war on the Western Front first. We want to deal with, in some detail, with the Americans at war, and finally the 100 Days battle that ended the war in 1918. Okay. Well, you recall that 1916 was hallmarked by these huge, well, big battles, Titanic in and of themselves, but really not nothing, but even less than what would come in 1917. All countries involved learned to create economies, to put more in ammunition production and artillery production, armaments production. They learned to bring more people into the factories, women, retired people, teenagers. They learned to harness, through the statist, total war methods, the very last workers they could find. In some areas, we get to forced labor. The Germans were sweeping up people in occupied Belgium and France and putting them into factories and forcing them to work. So there's every last effort. There's also synthetic nitrates. The Nobel-winning chemist Fritz Haber had, before the war, learned to fix nitrogen and create nitrates so that Germany, now that it was producing these artificial synthetic nitrates, didn't have to have a lifeline abroad for its explosives. And so Germany was producing more. So everybody's producing, even the Central Powers are producing more in the way of explosive power. And so when we get to 1917, there is no shell crisis because there are plenty of shells. By the way, I think I mentioned before that the shells, I mean, we're going to talk about some wide-ranging effects, health effects of shells, apart from the problematic health effects of having one explode close to you. But they certainly ruined the health of many of the workers. Imagine the conditions of handling highly toxic chemicals in these plants in a day when nobody thought a thing about that. The I think I've mentioned before, if I haven't, I should have, that the women who worked in munitions factories in England were called cutely canary girls because they actually had jaundice from their toxicity in those plants. I wonder what it did for their lives later on. So everybody has explosives, and to tell you the truth, I'll emphasize again that artillery comes to be the weapon of the war. We think of gas and we think of machine guns, but compared to the other weapons of World War I, artillery kills more than any of them. It's this explosive power, and I emphasize again that by 1917 there are all kinds of experiments with every sort of shell, just solid explosives, just TNT packed into the head of those. And of course, they're all fused, so you can make them blow up above the ground, or as they hit the ground, or in any place. An anti-personnel shell, which is loaded with metal balls, that is to say, shrapnel, and the shell itself becomes shrapnel, and that explodes above the ground. They filled them up with gas too. By 1917, you didn't have to turn the spigot on a canister and just hope it didn't blow back in your face. They fired off gas shells that dropped and gassed the enemy. They also were in the process of developing heavy metal burning shells, basically thermite shells, and that would spread unquenchable fire over a given area. So everybody's thinking of this. You remember that Pétain, the French general who saved Verdun from the German attack, that he said fire kills, firepower kills, meaning the artillery kills. Let the artillery conquer and infantry occupy. Well, everybody was thinking in terms of this. Everybody was understanding that this explosive force of artillery, and basically the explosive force of harnessing whole societies to produce artillery shells, and that goes back into Western civilization too. It goes back into the creation of the state. But everybody was thinking about this highly increased power of the artillery shell, and a number of people had plans to exploit it in the next big season after the Battle of Verdun petered out in the fall, and after the Battle of the British Somme offensive petered out, and after everybody thought about things over Christmas while the troops were freezing in the trenches. So what happened was that because of some international military politics and then some internal French politics, a person got promoted who was really unsuitable in many ways, but a very clever talker. And that was Robert Nivelle, the general we're looking at here on this slide. Nivelle was one of Pétain's commanders, along with General Mongin, that's M-A-N-G-I-N, but Nivelle was one of the commanders at Verdun, and thought that he had figured out in the battle how to win the war. And he had influential friends. Pétain himself was pretty much hated by the people in power because he kept on telling them hard truths, and he was the kind of person who didn't soften what he said at all. So Nivelle, who was a wonderful aristocratic speaker smooth talker, was able to talk his way into the command and then talk the allies, including General Haig, and also the British Prime Minister, Lloyd George, with whom he also communicated, into the support of a French offensive. His plan was total annihilation with artillery, then a rapid advance. Tanks were now being produced in great numbers. There would be enough tanks to really create a tank attack. And then General Nivelle guaranteed the war will be over in 2 days. There will be only no more than 10,000 casualties. But I mean, it just seems so ludicrous now. But he was very convincing, very convincing. And the character of General Haig, the low country Scotsman in all this, is really important. Haig had his own plans, but he realized that he merely had to let the French get what fight they could out of their troops before he developed his own plans, which were actually had more to do with German sub bases in the north of Europe. So Haig went along, and it included a British softening assault at the beginning, so that that would draw off a few troops, so that Nivelle could attack in the south. So this is a very important and huge part of the war for several reasons. It's about the ascendancy which Haig gained later. It's about the destruction of the French army. It's about so many aspects of the war. First, the British attacks. There were a number of British attacks which were, to tell you the truth, by and large successful. Very tough and ugly battles. The most prominent, and we will. I don't know if we have any of our. We have only 15 tonight, but. Certainly some of our Canadian students will know what I'm about to say. At Vimy Ridge, the Canadian contingents on the Western Front cooperated top to bottom to create a kind of textbook battle. There was a very tough ridge in Picardy in northern France, north of the Somme area at Arras, or outside Arras. The Canadians were chosen to do that and carry this out in exemplary fashion. As I've said before, once you get to the later stages of the war, the British Army almost never assaulted anything without either Australians or Canadians or New Zealanders or Irish at the front of the column. They were thought to be in the British Army just more aggressive. Aggressive troops than the English troops, who were thought to be better defenders, and so they assaulted with these other groups. So the Vimy Ridge attack was successful. This occurred in early March. A number of other British assaults were involved in this kind of thing. And Haig was guaranteed by Nivelle that if his assault did not work within a couple of days, that it would be called off. But that either way, the French would then take over some of the British line to shorten the British line to intensify their impact because Haig had his own plans, all right? So the Nivelle offensive results. Nivelle fired off his weapons, but in the end, 7,000 sounded like a lot of guns at the beginning, but stretched over many miles of enemy terrain. It just was not enough. I mean, there was no way that 7,000 guns, no matter what the size, could pulverize a strip of the Western Front, probably 1,000 yards deep and 10 or 12 miles wide. I mean, you just couldn't get enough explosives delivered to the point needed. So there was insufficient shelling. And in the wake of that, then, the French were supposed to renew their great assaults of previous years. And they did this predominantly at what's called the Second Battle of the Aisne River in the Champagne region. And the area itself is called the Chemin des Dames, the Road of the Ladies, the Avenue of the Ladies, a reference to, I mean, that's what this little region was called in previous times. And it's in the Champagne region, north of the city of Reims and in that area. So the attack came there. It was very ugly terrain. And these troops were sent in these sort of bald attacks. The artillery stopped. They were sometimes preceded by a walking barrage, but sometimes not. And it was absolute murder. We have all kinds of eyewitnesses on the German side who said that the Germans were simply astounded that the French would do this, that they would, at this stage of the war, just walk across no man's land or run across no man's land, where they were just all shot down. And it was clear to the troops this was just murder, but they kept attacking for 3 weeks. Nivelle forgot that he told everybody concerned that he would stop the attack after 2 days if it didn't work. Or rather, he interpreted the words "didn't work" a little bit differently from everybody else. I guess that's the fairer way to say it. But 3 weeks later, nearly 30,000 French soldiers had died in these vicious attacks, 187,000 total casualties and captured. And you can look at this map and see something about the great progress of it. We moved maybe 3 kilometers at deepest in this, there I get my arrow out. I never know if this thing will work or not, but there you see. At this, at deepest, in that little dotted area across the, right across the ridge of the Chemin des Dames, there was some progress up those hills. They did take the crest, and then just past the little town of Crayon, over here, there's another little bit that was taken. But you know, in terms of the whole thing, this is just minimal progress, and the army was completely wiped out. The worst winter of the war, the winter of 1916-17, had just happened. Soldiers were hungry. They had just fended off the Germans at Verdun. They had just attacked with the British at the Somme. They were tired of being killed. They were tired of these senseless assaults that any soldier on the front line would have known about. And the idea of a French officer, a French field grade officer in the front lines, was really a kind of rare occurrence. So those were the results, some of the results of the Nivelle offensive, but it got worse because the army mutinied. 30,000 Frenchmen deserted from this army over April, May 1917 at the end of the offensive. The actual attacks were stopped, but then continued again. About half of the divisions of the French army were affected by all this. And some people took off. I mean, 30,000 deserted, but there were a lot of Frenchmen on the Western Front, so it's not to say that everybody left. They were certainly thinned out. Some people just wouldn't go. Some men just went to the rear areas and said, well, we're not going in those front lines. We're not going in the trenches. The vast majority of these divisions, and it's about half of the divisions of the French army, and the majority of people in those divisions simply said, we won't attack anymore. We will hold these trenches. We'll fight a defensive war. We'll do our duty, but we will not attack anymore. In some places, the mutiny became rowdy, and Frenchmen marched, gangs of people marched to rear areas to loot and get food and so forth and so on. But for the most part, you see these this picture of French soldiers returning without weapons from the front lines. They have just deserted. Most stayed in place. It's not a question of a mass desertion, but a lot of people deserted. Well, Nivelle was fired, and that was the effective end of his military career. And the disliked but eminently capable Pétain replaced him. Pétain couldn't help the court martials. I'm not sure he would have been in favor of what happened, but about 40 were shot. Many, many more were sentenced to be shot and then had their sentences commuted or otherwise changed. Many, many more, several hundred were sent to penal servitude, some for 10 years, some for life, some for lesser amounts. But on the other hand, Pétain, though he oversaw this military justice, it's also true that he immediately changed the conditions of the fighting. He told Haig and the allies, the other allies, well, we simply are not going to do any more attacking right now. There's no offensive capability of this army for the moment. We are purely defensive, and that's that. And then he built up the men, started retraining and so forth and so on, so that by the time that the German spring offensive is going to come a year later, the French army is not dominating, but certainly back to the level of an attack force that does, in fact, take place in the 100 Days Battle very creditably. Nivelle was gone. Conditions were improved. But let me talk a little bit about mutinies in general, because, you know, it's not just Nivelle. It's not, we could blame a lot on Nivelle, and he's a very attractive character to blame these things on. He's, you know, for one thing, he looks almost exactly like the French general in that Kirk Douglas movie, Paths of Glory. So if you see that movie, the Adolphe Monjou character looks almost exactly like Nivelle, and that's probably no accident that they dressed him up to look that way. But there were many mutinies that surrounded this period of time. Again, I go back to this phrase, the deeper forces breaking through. I mean, it's almost like a kind of analysis, but with these millions of people involved everywhere and these forces of the state impacting every part of the battlefield and every part of society, then things begin to happen. It's almost as if Leviathan that Hobbes described actually came alive. So it spawns all these reactions and rashes and sicknesses and some real flus and some other things. I don't mean to be too mystical about all this, but there are a lot of mutinies. A lot of mutinies at this time. I'm just going to name a few of them here. There's the Houston Mutiny, August 1917. It's black troops in training in Houston, Texas, just outside town at Camp Logan. By and large, the story of black troops in World War I was this. They were not allowed. They were separate but equal. President Wilson was a Jim Crow president from way back. He thought that black people had no business owning guns, firing guns, being in the army. However, elite East Coast black families and black leaders saw war as fulfillment just like everybody else and thought just like the Irish did or the South Africans did that if they fought in the war, if they supported the effort, that they could come out ahead in the end. And that was their assumption. So they did form up black battalions and black regiments, which eventually would go to the Western Front, but were not permitted to fight, for the most part, with white units, except in the French Army. And This is a strange phenomenon, but everybody knew that in terms of being an imperializer, an imperial power, the French just paid less attention to race, and so the black units were actually welcomed into the French army. That's a different story. But while they were training in Houston, they went to Houston, which was not known as an especial hotbed of racism, and there had been no, unlike many cities in the South, there had been no lynchings there in the, at all, apparently. But this this training camp, a large training camp at Camp Logan of black troops, kept on being harassed by the local police. These guys would go into town on the edge of town to bars and other establishments set up for them, cafes and whatnot. And police would come around there and find means of just harassing them and beating them up, and frequently did just beat these soldiers who thought they were fighting for their country, who thought that these cracker cops in Houston had no business just beating them up. And then there were some disputes with citizens to some racial groups. There was not apparently much of a Ku Klux Klan or anything like that there, but there were a lot of frictions. And after an especially egregious case of this, you've got to, I don't know, if you're going to go brutalize a group of people, make sure that they're not people who are learning to shoot infield rifles and such weapons. So these guys took their rifles and just walked into town, and the cops and other citizens went and got their guns, and there was an honest-to-goodness firefight between these guys. And I am assured by my historian friends, Jacqueline Moore and Nina Maki, both of whom have written on this period, that this is the only race riot / conflict in American history in which more whites died than blacks. And the toll you can read there, it's 18 whites and 2 black soldiers. So there was this was regarded as a mutiny, which I really don't think it was, but in any case, it was called a mutiny, and 28 were sentenced to death and shot, and 40 were sentenced to life imprisonment and dozens to lesser sentences. That was just before the Acopal Mutiny in 1917. Look, these are all occurring in 1917. The Acopal camp was a horror. Many of the people who went through it said, you know, this is the worst place in the world. This is a place that's so bad. The instructors are so horrible. They're so heartless and brutal and Mickey Mouse and all of it, that literally almost everybody preferred to go to the trenches, the frontline trenches, rather than stay at Acopal, marching and training and running in the sand all day long and being harassed at night, rousted out of bed for every kind of Mickey Mouse kind of thing. So there was a provocation. At this time, it was not the local police, as in Houston, but the military police who a guy came back late and had to walk around a long way because this area was flooded, and so he was a little late, a New Zealander, and they arrested him and were going to punish him and do all the customary things. So soldiers gathered. There was a conflict. One of these MPs fired into the crowd and killed a soldier, and then the troops just took over. So there were hundreds of people milling around in the town of Acopal. They didn't do a lot of damage. They didn't go find every last officer and kill them or anything like that. But they were pretty angry. It was apparently a horrific, horrific place. By the way, you remember that this is the very same place that I believe in the theory of Dorothy Pettit. Can you see this book? Dorothy Pettit and Janice Bailey. A Cruel Wind. It's the one I recommended last week. The one about the Spanish influenza. One of the theories that they mentioned prominently is that Atapu was actually the place where the Spanish flu started, because it had both about 100,000 men, then all these pigs and birds in close proximity, swamping microbes and all that. So anyway, it was a horrible enough place. And anyway, at the end of this, the British were very, very restrained. They only shot one for this mutiny, and three were sentenced to penal servitude for 10 years, and then several more got lesser sentences. There were also, there were mutinies all over the place in this war. And 1917 seems, I mean, you get the odd mutiny. There were some Indian troops mutinied in Singapore in 1915, But even in Russia, the year of 19, it wasn't until 1917 that the vast mutinies occurred, where the men just took over and either killed their officers or degraded them in some way. A whole slew of Italian mutinies in 1917. So what we're looking at, again, is these deeper forces. And there's a poem about base camp, meaning the camp at Etaples in France. It's close to Boulogne. It's right on the channel. This is our poet, the British poet, Siegfried Sassoon, along with Wilfred Owen, one of the greats of the war, and also a person who, like Wilfred Owen, was on the very front lines in you know, the most extreme circumstances. But he wrote a poem about these camp guards. If I were fierce and bald and short of breath, I'd live with scarlet majors at the base and speed glum heroes up the line to death. You'd see me with my puffy, petulant face, guzzling and gulping at the best hotel, reading the roll of honor. Poor young chap, I'd say. I used to know his father well. Yes, we've lost heavily in this last scrap. And when the war is done and youth stone dead, I'd toddle safely home and die in bed. As long as I'm on this jag, I want to say something about Sassoon. Sassoon, like most people, signed up in a fit of enthusiasm, the dappled sunlight showing on him as he went to the recruiting station, just like everybody else. He came to see, being on the front, he came to be part of this huge conversion. And in my mind, it's a very positive conversion in many ways, of soldiers being able to see the falseness of the state. But to them, the falseness of the state comes in their view of basically of the brass hats, of the generals, who they come to view in a sense very much as the enemy, as opposed to the guys just across no man's land who are engaged in the same thing that we are, you see. Sassoon was wounded, shot, and he'd been wounded a couple of times, and been deathly sick from a fever and so forth, but was a very active, aggressive officer on the front, but was wounded out, shot in a raid during a raid while he was in no man's land. But he got home and he had been thinking more and more about the direction of the war, and he made this declaration and published it. A couple of newsmen encouraged him, and they published it in the newspaper, made the rounds. And he wrote this: "I am making this statement as an act of willful defiance of military authority, because I believe that the war is being deliberately prolonged by those who have the power to end it. I am a soldier, convinced that I am acting on behalf of soldiers. I believe that this war, on which I entered as a war of defense and liberation, has now become a war of aggression and conquest. I believe that the purpose for which I and my fellow soldiers entered upon this war should have been so clearly stated as to have made it impossible to change them. And that, had this been done, the objects which actuated us would now be attainable by negotiation. I've seen and endured the sufferings of the troops, and I can no longer be a party to prolong these sufferings for ends which I believe to be evil and unjust. I'm not protesting against the conduct of the war, but against the political errors and insincerities for which the fighting men are being sacrificed. On behalf of those suffering now, I make this protest against the deception which is being practiced on them. Also, I believe that I may help to destroy the callous complacency with which the majority of those at home regard the contrivance of agonies which they do not, in which they have not sufficient imagination to realize. So, luckily for Sassoon, he had friends in high places, and they all declared him mentally unstable and shell-shocked, and so he was taken to a mental institution called Craig Lockhart, where he met Wilfred Owen, and that's part of the famous story of the war. Let me quote somebody else just about the whole issue of training, the whole issue of dehumanization in the real sense of trying to make people less than human. And this is from a British, eventually a general. I mean, he ended the war as a commander of the Royal Irish, he was commander of the Royal Irish Rifles and eventually a division commander. But here's what he says about training soldiers. I, for my part, do what I can to alter completely the outlook, bearing, and mentality of over 1,000 men. Bloodlust is taught for the purpose of war, in bayonet fighting itself, and by doping their minds with all propagandic poison. The German atrocities, many of which I doubt in secret, the employment of gas in action, the violation of French women, the official murder of Nurse Cavell, all help to bring the brute-like bestiality which is necessary for victory. The process of seeing red, which has to be carefully cultured if the effect is to be lasting, is elaborately grafted into the makeup of even the meek and mild. The Christian churches are the finest bloodlust creators we have, and of them we must make full use. Well, as I've mentioned in passing about the mutinies, there's a lot of shooting going on in this war. This is in the wake of the mutiny, or during the mutiny at Verdun at that point on the line. And you see the commander in the background with his sword up. You see the officer of the squad there shooting the blindfolded man who has undoubtedly deserted or refused to attack or whatever. This is not an isolated case. I mean, we don't have that many pictures of these things, but they're far from isolated. Here's a Belgian volunteer. Elois Walcott is his name, who's just been shot in this photograph a few seconds before, 30 seconds before, the commander is actually the physician is checking his watch for the time to note that down. The soldiers are just untying him from the post that he was tied to. In this war, military justice took the lives of hundreds of people. It may be surprising to you that the British were right up there with the highest, and the Germans were rather on the low end of things. Overall, Germany executed only 18 for cowardice or desertion in this war, which is really an amazing figure. The French were at the high end of the ones we're considering here. I don't have the figures for the Russians. I assume the Russians had a very high rate of execution, and I just didn't get around to checking that. Maybe Cam will know more in a few minutes. If I know him, he will. So the French shot something over 600 soldiers for desertion in the war. About 300-ish. I'll take that back. Let's just say 600 total. Although there are times early in the war when the French chose some units that had run and just shot every tenth one of those people, so that's part of the total too. British court martials condemned many, many more than 306 soldiers, but in some way those other cases were dismissed, and 306 soldiers were shot. In the British Army, it was always at dawn, so shot at dawn was the sentence, and that included several from the Empire, 25 Canadians, 22 Irishmen, 5 New Zealanders. Australia refused to allow its volunteer soldiers to be executed, which is interesting. These are just executions for cowardice or desertion or dereliction of duty or sleeping on guard or whatever. There's a whole other category of execution for just normal criminal activity. And men were shot for rape and for other crimes. They were punished for theft and so forth. There's a whole range of military punishments, but one of them was field punishment number one, which was tying people up to the wheel of a wagon and leaving them out for 3 or 4 days in all weathers and to be kind of an object of derision, something like an old pillory. But in any case, this military justice, I think, is an important part of our understanding of this war. That these soldiers, especially in countries where they use conscription, they were forced at pain of death to walk into death. And so I think that's important to know about this war. You know, another aspect of all this that I think is very important, and I may have mentioned this early in the course just briefly, but I want you to know about Tony Ashworth's excellent book, and I have it here to show. It's been reprinted since it was published in 1980. Tony Ashworth wrote a book called Trench Warfare, 1914 to 1918, The Live and Let Live System. And it's one of the most brilliant of these early sort of works, scholarly works, that went into the nuts and bolts of the First World War and revived the study of it in earnest, so that now we have a wealth of specific information on this war. It's not just a matter of some journalistic exploration or somebody kind of thinking of one small part of the war. But what Ashworth did as a sociologist, he thought, let me look at the broader patterns here, and he began to work out a geography of the trenches first. He read the memoirs, he read the official documents, he looked at trench maps, and he began to work out the spatial relationships of the Western Front. It's a fascinating thing. And in the process of this, he really discovered that in almost all the memoirs, there's some kind of mention of what he calls the live and let live system. And he takes that from many specific memoirs, where they say, yeah, we have the live and let live system. That system was this. That soldiers on the front began very early in the war being in proximity to the enemy to create in what the sociologist Ashworth calls informal truces. And they're truces that are based on symbolic communication, nonverbal communication, and sometimes really verbal communication as well. But one of his heroes from a memoir is a young officer who gets to the trenches on the first night, and he gets out in a little sap there, and out into no man's land, a little post, and they're observing, and they can see the Germans milling around at some spot on their line. And he says to the sergeant, shouldn't we get back to battalion and tell them to bomb those people? And the sergeant says, well, if we give them something, we'll get summit back. We'll get something back. So this tipped Ashworth off. He began to look at it, and he realized that there are all kinds of accounts of William Kipling's famous book on the Irish Guard, one of the most aggressive and non-truce-like units in the whole war. One day their trenches were flooded. Well, the German trenches were flooded too. And they all got up on the ground and looked at each other and kind of waved. And well, they couldn't be in the war. The trenches were filled up to the very top. I mean, there was 6 or 7 feet worth of water in everybody's trenches. And so they just stood there for several hours waiting for the water to subside and run off. And eventually it did. And at the end of it, one of the officers on each side sort of nodded at each other. They both held up their pistols and fired them in the air, and everybody crawled back down into the muddy trenches. So there were these truces, as Ashworth calls them, informal truces that were carried out. In some cases, in one case he mentions, there's people went to the there were several quite visible latrines in the you know, a few hundred yards back behind the line, and people quite visibly would go to the latrine. And it was amazing to the memoirist who was looking at it until he realized that the other side had a latrine out too, and so both had their latrines, and by agreement they would just not bomb each other. There are fascinating cases of patrols going across no man's land at night, just ignoring each other. Here's the thing. Well, the Christmas truce, the one that broke out in 1914, that's a perfect example of these informal truces. It really happened. It really was widespread, and these soldiers got together. And it's not, it's a myth that all the officers were cashiered in the wake of that. I think they were enjoined not to let it happen again. But the high command was very cognizant of this. And thereafter, after the Christmas truce, began to move in a direction that Ashworth notes carefully. He's got the military records, and he sees that at every stage of, as the war moves on, the weapons that are not designed for military success, but rather to keep people aggressive, are increased and increasingly put higher up, not in platoon reach or company reach, or oftentimes even battalion reach, but they're put up under the command of divisions, sometimes even even armies. So, for example, there are weapons that really don't make any difference in the war, like trench mortars. It's a small mortar. It's designed to do not very much damage. It has a very small shell, but at least a three-man team can carry it around. It's highly mobile. Well, in the Western Front, a trench mortar team would come to a spot on the Western Front, you know, in the trenches, set up their little tripod and the mortar, break out the shells, pump a dozen, 20 rounds to the trench opposite, just 100 yards away, 150 yards away, then pack up the tripod, take the tube out, pack up the shells, and take off. So when the enemy retaliated back onto the trench of where the fire had just come from, it would be the poor infantry soldiers there who were in the trench mortar team would be long gone. Same way with rifle mortar teams, same way with sharpshooters. All of these things were increased in number hugely over the course of the war, where there might be one trench mortar per company at the beginning of the war. At the end of the war, there were 30, and they all were under the control of the division. So the division would send these guys out so they wouldn't be kept at bay by the officers closest to the front. Also, the high commands ordered trench raids and trench patrols, no man's land patrols at night, the very kind that Sassoon got shot in, totally unnecessary. I mean, very often they'd go over and snatch somebody. They'd make a raid on the opposite trench, creep up on a trench area, try to snatch a soldier so they could get supposedly military intelligence. But I ask you, and I'm sure there's somebody in this, probably several of you in this class who have been in the military, how many soldiers did you ever know who were in combat who had any information that was worth snatching them for? I mean, they're underground. They don't know any bigger issues. They might be able to tell you, of course they can tell you what their outfit is, but you know, on the whole, to endanger the lives of 20 or 30 men to get the name of the outfit opposite when you probably already know it, it's just not cost effective. But these trench raids kept everybody angry, buzzing like bees, and that was the purpose. In any case, Ashworth believes that maybe about half of the time on the Western Front, there would be a quiet sector where these things were involved. But of course, when a big battle was on, then all of this went by the wayside. Anyway, it's important to mention, I've talked about it before in a question and answer, but I did want to get this in, because as I see it, this is the beginning of a tendency at the low point of the war where these deeper forces do break through. Also, a deeper force of individualism breaks through. And I don't regard these people who engaged in the trench truces, the informal truces, in any way, but as individuals attempting to take back their own lives. So I think this is an important thing to take note of. Just quickly, since I'm running down the course of the war, I do want to mention a couple of things in other theaters. The Eastern Front, the collapse of Russia with the takeover of the Bolsheviks by the Bolsheviks in October, November 1917, and then the breaking out of the Civil War, where they were tending to cement their power and keep it. In the midst of this, Lenin sent Trotsky to negotiate with the Allies, with the Germans in the West. And at first, the watchword was no war, no peace, and Trotsky just wouldn't say anything except lecture the Germans. But when the Germans took a few thousand more square miles of Russian territory, then the Russians came back and negotiated the Peace of Brest-Litovsk, which actually was a very important thing for the Bolsheviks in that Lenin swapped one-third of European Russia for a peace with the Germans, a harsh peace, but still a peace. Lenin said, what does it matter if we give away a third of European Russia? The world's going to be in revolution here before very long anyway, so it won't matter. But this Brest-Litovsk is extremely important because with a peace on the Eastern Front, an official signed peace, then the troops really could be released. And so it's at this point in March 1918 that hundreds of thousands of troops could come from the Western, from the Eastern Front to the West, or from the Austrian Front to the Austrian-Russian Front to the Italian Front. And that happened very rapidly. Other developments in the Middle East, with all the British disasters there, in December 1916, the British did an unlikely thing, and it was unlikely to have any results, but they did send a young officer, a head officer, an archaeologist who worked in the map division named T.E. Lawrence, and did I misspell his name? I believe I did. I believe it's L.A.W. And a few other people to the Arabian Hashemite dynasty, a group of Arabs from Mecca, a family of Arabs. And with this family, they contrived to create the famous revolt in the desert. And so, I really did murder this paragraph. I must have been typing pretty fast. The forces of Lawrence, misspelled, took Aqaba in July 1917 in an unforgettable thing, if you've actually seen the movie. Let me go to this. Here's a photograph I ran across that looks like it should be the scene from the movie, but actually this is a real scene of the actual attack on Aqaba. I think that's a pretty amazing photograph. We, you know, it's years ago, John Keegan in his book, The Face of Battle, wrote that there are very few pictures of combat, actual combat in World War One. But over the years, many, many more have emerged, and the internet has helped with this because people, they find something in their attic and then they sell it on eBay and somebody puts it online, and so we get to have these pictures. But this, I think, is a wonderful picture of of the assault on Aqaba against the Turks by T.E. Lawrence, but more by the Arab forces of Abu Taib and the Hashemite kings. So I'll go back here and just say that eventually he cobbled these groups together to be a kind of flanking movement to Allenby's move north. And indeed, this flanking protected movement actually beat Allenby to Damascus by October 1918. So the war is beginning to go against the Turks in the Middle East. On the home front, there are explosive strikes that really, there are some strikes throughout the war, but they really begin to pick up in 1917, as you might expect. Of course, there are major strikes in Russia that are precursors to an accompaniment to the revolution. In the UK, there's a great conscription crisis of April 1918. That was, Cam says no military executions in Russia. I was wrong about that. He says no military executions. Wow. We'll have to go into that later. Cam, I hope you can tell us why in just a little bit. I'm kidding. You don't have to, but it would be interesting to know. But the conscription crisis it came with an extension of conscription to Ireland, where basically everybody had volunteered, and the Irish had volunteered in droves for this war. The Irish fought in all units, and then had many of their own units, like the 36th Irish Division, and numerous other, the Irish Guard was largely Irish, numerous other divisions. And so the British decided to get some more troops. And when they did this, and there was basically almost a mutiny, a public mutiny in Ireland itself that started on Dublin, and actually went around the Celtic periphery. There was very much unrest, labor strikes, public strikes, people boycotting government offices and whatnot, but especially in Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. In Germany, there were strikes that began to get rolling in 1916 during the horrible losses of Verdun and the strains on the munitions factories and so forth. And in 1917, they increased. By January, there were 500,000 munitions workers on strike just in January alone. So there's pretty massive strikes exploding at home. And then there's the real explosions, I mean literal ones. I think this is an important part of the home front. Certainly, does a lot of killing. I mean, not compared to the war fronts, but if you look down this list, the Faversham munitions plant in the UK, 1916, Black Tom, New Jersey, explosion, 1916, and we were just making shells for the British, right? The Silverton explosion, 1917, and then Kingsland, 1917. That's the one pictured in the top photograph there. Maybe you can enlarge that if you download this. And all of these kill from 50 to 100 to 150 people. But of course, the next one, the Halifax explosion, is not a factory. It's a ship that's filled with munitions in Halifax harbor, and there's a collision in the harbor and an explosion. 2,000 dead in that city, which has suffered so much death and destruction from survivors of disasters and whatnot. But there's their own tragedy there. Chilwell, UK, 1918. Morgan Depot, New Jersey, 1918. You name it. I didn't even get to the Germans in this, but there are, by the way, the bottom photograph is the Halifax explosion. But many of these explosions, they're all blamed on the Germans. They're all blamed on sabotage, and a few of them probably were. Probably Black Tom was a sabotage. But a lot of these explanations are made up. A lot of it was propaganda. I mean, the government doesn't want to say, well, we're sponsoring this munitions program, and it's extremely dangerous, and it's toxic to you, and you could blow up at any moment. I mean, they don't want to say that. So I think if we, a fair investigation is going to demonstrate that the Germans were not nearly the explosive saboteurs that they were cracked up to be. Many of these were accidental explosions, obviously, and certainly everybody knows that the Halifax explosion, which killed the most people at once of all of them, was an accident. People saw it happen in the harbor, no sabotage needed. So there are explosions in on the battlefield, explosions at home, and so forth. Well, to get back to the and finish up our war front survey here, basically the next thing that happens is, remember, Haig wanted the French to take over more of the line so he could carry out his own project. Well, the French were, of course, too exhausted and shaken and decimated by the mutiny and the Nivelle offensive that they couldn't take over any more front. But Haig wanted to go ahead, and here he starts basically the third battle of Ypres, and we call that Passchendaele because it was all aimed at a certain point on the ridge. Remember, Ypres is this town that has a semicircle, a long ridge that comes up to it and then makes a semicircle around it, like a saucer or half a saucer. So the town is in this part of the half saucer, and the rim is all ridges. So the Germans were looking down from three sides onto the city of a very prosperous market town of Ypres in Belgium. And probably that's how you see all these pictures of the cloth wall in Ypres, proudly rebuilt today, I might add. It's in the church right behind it, which is also rebuilt. But in any case, Haig wanted to do the hard thing. He wanted to break through the strength of the Germans. And so at the highest point of this ridge, at Passchendaele in Flemish, at Passchendaele, as we all call it, then the assault started right after the disasters of the Nivelle offensive. And so his theory is that he wants it there because what he wants to do is push the Germans far enough back that they have to move back. And it enables him to, in the north, to get to some exposed submarine bases that the Germans have. So there's a reason for this, that it's all about the blockade and resources and the war of resources and the war of attrition and all that. And so he does have an object in mind. So he attacks. It's uphill all the way to the top of the ridge, and it's a pretty stiff climb. From the top of the ridge, you can see all of Ypres. From Ypres, you can see the top of the ridge in most parts of town. And so there are several miles, but the object is miles away. When on the western front, think about it, a few feet is a big advance. The battle, or the campaign, I should say, started off in June and only ended in November 1917. With all the bombing that had gone on at Ypres, remember there were spots there that were probably more bombed than any spot on the face of the earth. And what happens is that the weather goes bad, so it starts raining a lot. But all that land, all of the drainage ditches and bar ditches and little canals, there are a lot of canals there draining, you know, channeling the water to make the land dry. And then all the natural streams, all that's disrupted because all the land is just pummeled up and fouled up in these willy-nilly by the bombs. So the water dispersion system is completely wrecked. And then when the weather turns really, really rainy, it didn't rain every day, but it rained a lot of days, much more than often, then this attack was not only uphill, but in mud that was sometimes 3 or 4 feet deep. I read an account once, a memoir account of some British officers who young lieutenants who got out of the trenches, and their great coats, like this one. This is a, I think you can see this. This is an American great coat from the war, copied on the pattern of the British. It's wool. It's heavy anyway. It's many, many pounds anyway. But with that mud and the water soaking in, they wondered how much their trench coats weighed. I mean, this sounds like some 22 or 23-year-old guys, you know, out of the front lines, just glad to be warm again. They say, "Hey, let's weigh our coats and see how much they weigh." And one of them, one of these guys, weighed his greatcoat. It weighed 110 pounds. Yes. So the water could soak up in anything, and it was, apart from the horrible nature of just the battle, then there's the horrible nature of the terrain and that makes this such a sad battle. And since, you know, there's also the echoes of the place itself, there's this idea of the passion of the soldiers moving up, and so a lot of authors have commented on that. I mean, imagine getting wounded in that, on that battlefield. Imagine the mud and the filth and the wreckage and the metal and the chemicals and all of that, all being, you know, basically mixed into your wound. How many kinds of sepsis can you get? How many kinds of toxicity in a single place? Plus, the idea, you see the idea here, the problematic nature of getting anybody back to an aid station in any sort of time. Once you're in no man's land, you're cut off basically from medical services, except you're very, very lucky. So we have that. Okay, so Passchendaele stopped. The British had gone a few miles, but I've got to tell you, we're about to talk about a battle which ate them all up within 2 weeks. In other words, all of the months of Passchendaele were wiped out in March and April 1918. But first, just a comment about the Americans. You know, he kept us out of war. This war is going to be the war to end wars, the war to make the world safe for democracy. How many awful phrases can one person make up? But our president was able to do that. So the Americans come in April 1917. And immediately, a general is appointed, John J. Pershing, who had been a commander in many imperial scrapes. He had been a commander of Buffalo soldiers, been in the very tail end of the Indian Wars, and commander in the Philippines. Of course, he was chosen to chase Pancho Villa in the invasion of Mexico, 1916. And so, in that way, fit in very well with the European commanders. In fact, I think he was a very compared to most of those commanders, I think he was a very good soldier. Partly, he was aware of American military doctrine, which was frankly a more technical doctrine than any of the European military doctrines, because where a lot of them relied on sort of mystical powers of various kinds of soldiers to win the battle, and you get to a kind of Nivelle-like floating fancy of the war being over in 2 days. On the other hand, Pershing knew all the literature of the American military, from Hardy's treatises on gunfire. He knew all about the Civil War doctrines of concentration of fire. There had been a huge debate after the Civil War in the American Army about the deadly ground, meaning the fire zone where the bullets were actually flying, and since that got so long with rifled weapons, both artillery and infantry handheld weapons, then there was a debate as to how you get soldiers across that. I mean, it's such a horrific zone where you're marching. It's no longer 150 yards the way it used to be in the old days with muskets. It's now 1,000 yards where you're in danger. So how do you get through that? And the Americans had talked a lot about that and trained a lot for it, and Pershing was well aware of all this. So in any case, he took command. Now, strangely, And I think this is very strange. Baker, the Secretary of War, and Woodrow Wilson just kind of chose Pershing and said, surrounded him by their agents and some agents of the banking fraternity. You won't be surprised at that. His purchasing agent was Charles G. Dawes, who would later, as an agent of the House of Morgan, go and negotiate with Germany in 1924 to make the Dawes Plan. But in any case, Pershing himself seems not to have gotten any instructions, special instructions from Woodrow Wilson, except just to go win the war. Nothing on how to the American forces should be integrated or who he should take orders from or whatever. So the American Expeditionary Force was formed. Pershing went over, and practically he was it. He and a few staff officers were it in June 1917. They went secretly aboard a boat, got to Europe. One of his colonels made a beautiful speech when they landed at Le Havre and said, "Lafayette, we are here." It was a big thing that Lafayette was, of course, one of the, well, he was at that point the only honorary citizen of the United States, and certainly the most honored European in the United States, friend of Washington, friend of Thomas Jefferson, general in the Continental Army. There's the whole idea, this whole enthusiasm of Lafayette, we are here. And Pershing fostered that. It's interesting that Pershing felt much more kinship with the French than with the British. He felt much more trust. So when he arrived, he really began negotiating as to how the Americans would behave. Now remember, the British would have preferred just to have supplies from America and then a lot of raw troops. And immediately what Haig and the other British military people told Pershing was, well, luckily you don't have much to do here. All you have to do is just send troops to us and we'll put them into our companies. In other words, just the individual troops. And Pershing said no. And they said, well, you can then send them by platoons and we'll put them in our companies. And he said no. And there were bitter struggles over this. And he just refused flatly. In fact, the British said, well, then we'll train your troops. And Pershing said, no, I don't really like those trenches that you British make because they seem too comfy to me. I'd rather have the French trenches that are basically just kind of foxholes. And he said, I like their idea of attack. It's more in consonance with American military doctrine. So, for the most part, the AEF trained with the French. And I've already mentioned that all the black troops were actually put into French divisions, and those regiments performed as part of French divisions. AEF troops trained. In one or two cases, they were put in the line in platoons with some British companies to sort of get a feel for battle. And a number of troops made it into the line in 1917 in that capacity. So some American troops saw combat as early as 1917. But the first casualties were an American battalion actually attacked, were at the Battle of Contigny in January 1918, and then more and more were filtered in. There got to be more and more organization of the Western Front and of the American Army on the Western Front. And eventually the American First Army was formed, and that seems to be blank. And I erased it accidentally. There was another slide there, and it just said that the American First Army, we'll look at a blank screen, that's okay. But the American First Army, by the way, that's Pershing saluting Lafayette's grave right in that top picture there. This is all, you can go to Paris today. If you go to Paris today, you can see they stand in the very same spot and salute that grave yourself. But in any case, that's Pershing. But the Americans built their army, and they were all ready for action in the spring of 1918 when another big offensive arose, the spring offensive that Ludendorff is now planning. It's Ludendorff again. You just wouldn't believe that guy would pop up so much in a single war. But What he does is to take all the changes, some, many of which we've discussed, some of which we haven't, stormtroop tactics or Hoosier tactics, new systems of firing machine guns over ridges onto soldiers who are out of sight, new artillery methods of boxing in a battlefield and putting a box of fire around a given battle to prevent reinforcements from coming, storming the trenches with one set of troops, holding them with the other. All of these tanks, flamethrowers, all of it, air support, tactical air. And the idea is that you bring all these troops from the Eastern Front, and it's a gamble, but and probably a gamble that the Germans didn't need to take. But because if they had held out with all those extra troops, then it's hard to see that even with the Americans in it, that the Germans could have been budged, and that they couldn't have worn the Americans down after a while. But in fact, Ludendorff decided to roll the dice, the offensive would be coordinated in four big attacks launched on March 21, just 13 days after Brest-Litovsk was concluded with the Soviets. And this spring offensive, or Ludendorff offensive, sometimes called the Kaiser's Battle, was all but successful. Here are pictures of German troops attacking, and if you can believe it, those are horses that you see riding over captured British trenches. All of the gains of 1917, 1916, all those gains are wiped out in 3 weeks. And Haig is pushed back. They don't quite take Ypres, but they flow around it and take more territory. Haig put out his special order of the day on April 11th, 1918. And this says basically our backs, literally, our backs are against the wall. And we have to fight or we're going to be pushed off this continent. So that's how close it came. But into this gap, among other things, came the Americans. And by this time, the U.S. Marines have a full division on hand. The American Army has the 26th Division, the 1st Division, the 3rd Division, which came to be called the Rock of the Marne because they were put on the Marne to protect against these waves of the Germans who were pushing right up against Paris. The Americans had their backs to Paris, 25 or 30 miles behind them were the first bits of Paris. And those Marines fighting in that top picture in the Belleau Wood, these U.S. Army soldiers arriving in Chateau Thierry they stemmed the tide of the Germans, along with Senegalese troops and French troops and Portuguese troops and so forth and so on. But they really made a huge difference. Even as the American First Army was being formed and engaged in its first big fight at Samuel in September 1918, and later that month, a massive offensive at the Argonne Wood. That was all part of 100 days of battle that Haig, now commander of the entire front, was ordering so that the French and the British and the Americans were all on the offensive. The Americans passed up the Argonne Wood, made it to the assault on the Hindenburg Line, October 1918, et cetera, et cetera. American had 320,000 battle casualties, about 200,000 or 300,000 soldiers in Europe, 53,402 battle deaths, 63,000 non-combat deaths, and eventually 204,000 wounded. Now, you tell me, did American intervention make a difference? I misspelled intervention. I'm sorry about that. Did American intervention make a difference? It had to. At this point in the wall, backs to the wall, backs to the ocean, Haig is about to contemplate pulling his army out of Europe entirely and leaving the French to the mercies of the Germans. Yes, it made a difference. Well, as we come to the end of this, our last phase of this lecture, and we'll start our question and answer here in just a second, I do want to talk just a little bit about the horrors of this war. I mean, we've read Wilfred Owen and talked about him, read several of his poems and seen bits and pieces. Well worth reading. I mean, just reading deeply into Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon, just absolutely wonderful, biting critiques of this horrific war. The German Otto Dix, whom I had you look at a couple of pictures of, but one is this triptych on war, and it's a triptych is of course a traditional religious. It's the closest thing that the Western Church has to an icon, basically. And here it's a triptych not of the Ascension, or a triptych not of heavenly things, but of the horrors of battle, of the cramped spaces, the ruined lives, the bones, the impersonal soldiers, and so forth. And I think that Dix is if you look up Otto Dix and follow up his whole interpretation of the war, you will see a horrific scene. Part of the broken man generation, part of the wave of All Quiet on the Western Front, which came out in 1929, all the soldiers' memoirs, which came in a flood beginning in about 28, 29, talking about the extent to which the war was horrible, it echoing Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon. Albert Egger Linz, an Austrian artist, I think gives us some food for thought. This is his painting, Den Namenlosen, which he painted in 1916. And he's really thinking here about the depersonalization, not so much the nameless themselves, but the people who've had their names taken away. I mean, they're just depersonalized and dehumanized in the way that Crozier was actually discussing openly in his memoir, which I read above. So this is to the nameless. And this is certainly one reaction to the war, but I want to end with another reaction. I want to end on a positive note, because this war that we get to the end of in November 1918 has a lot of effects on a lot of people. It smashes people's faces and ruins their lives and disrupts families and brings about the total state. I mean, it's pretty much what our password for this course is. It's just pretty much calamity, you know. But there are more ways to take. There are more ways to look at it than that. And I think that there is this kernel of hope there, and a positive feeling. I don't know if you know all these people. Let me just name them. Top row, left to right, A. Milne, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, down in the bottom row, Enid Bagnold, then Eric Kessner, then Jean de Brunhoff. Finally, Hugo Fielding. And so what do these people have in common? Well, for one thing, they were all on the Western Front. Even Enid Bagnold, who was a VAD nurse, so she was in a nursing station just behind the front lines and saw really the worst that war can offer. I mean, it's people not just lying in a shell hole bed, but people who are torn apart but living. And so she saw these horrors. Certainly at first hand too, as did each of these people, and they all ended up writing famous children's books. Indeed, if you add to these people a few more, the Madeline books by an Austrian author whose name I forget now, if you add up Walt Disney, who got to the Western Front 2 days after November 11th, If you add in a number of other people, you get the absolute classics of children's literature from these guys. From A.A. Milne, of course, Winnie the Pooh. I assume you read or will read this part in the book, but this is something that occurred to me as I was in the midst of this book. A.A. Milne, actually, the Winnie the Pooh comes from the Winnipeg Division's mascot. C.S. Lewis, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, an absolute and utter classic. Tolkien, no more mentioned. In other words, they go from the Western Front, and then they write inspiring stories of deep humanity and deep individualism even. If you haven't read National Velvet, that was Enid Bagnold's book. It's well worth a read, and there's no book that's more about overcoming some problems by personal effort, by internal fortitude, and so forth. Eric Kästner wrote a number of children's books. Most importantly, Emil, he was in the German army. Emil and the Detectives, which is one of my favorites. You may know that from the Walt Disney movie in the 60s. The next man is Jean de Brunhoff, who actually, that's a pen name. He was in the German army in the First World War, and then he wrote the Babar books. He invented the character of Babar. Hugo Fielding was on the Western Front, indeed got the idea for his Dr. Doolittle books when he saw a wounded horse on the ground, the army vets sitting around trying to figure out where the horse was wounded, and obviously in pain, but he said, you know, if the doctors could only talk to these animals and the animals could tell them where it hurts, this would be a much better thing. So there are more than Bemelmans, Ludwig Bemelmans in the Madeleine books and others as well. But I think that these people saw something in this war and went, used it to argue against the collectivism, the dehumanization of the war. And then I want to end this with another reaction to this war, and that reaction's name is Mises and Hayek. It's the Austrian School of Economics and the rebirth of the of what seemed to have been wiped out in the war. This with this total war, the rebirth of the future, we hope. So that's the end of the of our lecture 7, and I'm going to look back through these comments. I've just glanced over a few, and it looks like we've got a lot of stuff on there already that is food for thought, is stuff in the philosophical sense. It's Stoff, and it's the material from which we can work. So let me just run down this list and see if we have something that would be of use. I like that. Artillery adds dignity to what would otherwise be a brawl. Excellent. That sounds like Frederick the Great. That military execution, you know, I want to say I've heard that before, but I really, when I was putting this together, I thought, oh, they probably had a lot. So that's an interesting thing. I need to ask, you know, I've met Norman Stone recently, and I need to ask him about that at some point. So he wrote that great book on the Eastern Front. He will be able to tell me. Here's a question, I think, from Laura Hyatt-Smith, who says, considering what happens in World War II and of Russian history in general, I find that number hard. Well, it's a comment. Yeah, we need to look at that. And Cam is still on it. It's very interesting. Yeah, he says maybe they shot so many they didn't keep track. Okay. It's a discussion, a good discussion of that. Yeah, I think that's possible, Laura, maybe the records. Okay, and Cam says this. Now, this is interesting. Reminds me of the Roman term double death. The Scythians fired arrows tipped with snake venom. If the wound did not kill you, the poison would. Yikes. Okay. Those Scythians, you just can't, you know, you just can't, I don't know, tolerate. Anyway, Tom Peeler says, I spent 25 years in the USMC as an infantry officer. It's 8 active, 17 reserve. We're called active duty for Desert Storm in command of an infantry battalion. Well, you certainly have some, you certainly have a platform there to speak from. Fortunately for me, in all that, I never heard a shot fired in anger. What makes my makes my blood run cold now to ponder it. Maybe with age comes a little wisdom. Bella Wood, of course, has iconic status in the Marines. It's where we received the nickname Devil Dogs. Yeah, I mean, that photograph also, Tom, I mean, to me, this is the greatest photograph of the war, and I don't know how they got it. I mean, you can only imagine the Marine photographer out there himself crouching in some kind of hollow, taking that picture, which it has all the evidence that the scrunched in necks of, you know, all the evidence of fire whizzing over their head, bullets whizzing over their head. So that's a very interesting comment. Yeah, devil dogs indeed. Well, those three fights, the fight on the Marne River up the hill, there's the Chateau Thierry fight, where the Americans and the Senegalese just basically joined at the bridge and just stopped the Germans from coming. Then up the hill a couple of miles, Belleau Wood, where the Marines did the same thing, but on a high hill, on a ridge there. And then farther up behind that hill, up along the Marne River in a flat stretch, where basically Americans stood there all day and in the 3rd Division, and just fought Germans off hand to hand, as Germans themselves, in an incredible, unbelievable attack in canvas boats across that river to the waiting arms of these people. I mean, it's just unbelievable what kind of fighting was going on there, and what kinds of courage people have. I mean, it's humbling. So Cam says, if you want to see some of the horrors of war, type in World War One shell shock. Yeah, this is a horrific thing that it's almost not to be believed. I've seen those films, and they just won't leave. So, yeah, all of these shells. I mean, it's not just the shell shock was not just the shelling, but the shelling had a big part of it, and the noise had a big part of it, and the disruptions of inner ear, and this, and that combined with fear. But other people, they call shell shock different things. They said that Wilfred Owen had shell shock because he had been in a dugout that was bombed in, and he spent about 3 days pinned in this place with body parts of one of his friends around him. And so he was not quite the same after this, and that's when they sent him home and sent him to this place, Craig Lockhart. And they called him Shell Shock. And by the way, there was this amazing physician there who, and of course that was a place for officers, right? But it was a place where the man was an enthusiastic Freudian, and applied what they at the time called the talking cure for one of the first times in sort of clinical way, especially dealing with larger numbers of people. And they thought they got a lot of value from these talks. I mean, part of what they did for soldiers, the amazing thing is, well, there's an amazing part of this. They, for soldiers who were subjects to this real shell shock and had these jitters and all these horrific tics and things, they try to get them to do something. It's like weaving baskets. And, you know, you hear about basket weaving. Well, they had them weave baskets and even do knitting and crochet and kinds of gentle little constructive things. And they found that helped. And then after a while, they went through a series of tests. And basically, this is the horrible part, one of the horrible parts. They had them then start shooting guns, just pistols, and then bigger and bigger weapons so that they could get back on the front later on. It's quite amazing. There's a lot of official callousness there, and plenty of personal callousness too. I tend to think that the medical advances in this war were rather individuals than institutions, and I think Craig Lockhart was a place just like the place I mentioned before, where the British doctors and nurses and orderlies teamed together to put people's faces back together. The Royal Hospital at Sidcup These were individuals. I don't think the government gave them any brief to do that. So anyway, that's very interesting. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Kim. Louis Maynard says, were the officers in charge in the trenches in favor of those truces that he talks about? Did the measures to prop up rivalry between belligerents come from the bureaucracy or the officers on the actual terrain? A very good question, Louis. And I think that some of the officers from these memoirs, I mean, when this sergeant, when the old sergeant tells the new young lieutenant, you know, if we give them something, they'll give us something back, this lieutenant says nothing. And I think it had to do with the sentiment of the person. It had to do with the aggressiveness of the unit. And a lot of those officers on the ground would say, no, we call it in and bomb those guys anyway, especially in the units like the various British Guards units, like the French Foreign Legion units, who are highly aggressive and highly gung-ho and all that. I think a lot of those guys would have, you know, reported in and had them bombed and then suffered the consequences. But many officers went along when they saw that, especially later in the war. I mean, Sassoon and Wilfred Owen were gung-ho in the beginning, and they were in gung-ho units too. But the longer they were in the war, the more they began to see, well, what is a no man's land patrol do except endanger people and get people riled, get the other side riled up and start a little firefight at night and maybe something more. So I think that those officers, many officers gradually came to that realization and supported these truces. I mean, it would be hard not to support a truce that enabled you to go to a you know, a solid kind of latrine outhouse type affair and you know, have a real toilet on hand. So that was often the case. Laura says, your book spoke about a lack of scholarship about the environmental consequences of World War I. Since it seems like an important aspect of Reconstruction, for example, the French color system of blue, yellow, and red, has this lack of investigation been rectified at all? You know, Laura, I don't know of anybody who's dealt with it. There may be some articles that have come out in journals that I haven't seen, but I just don't know. I just don't know of anybody. You know that book. I mentioned in my list of favorites, and now I forget the name of the man who wrote that. I can look it up here in a second. But that book, After the Ruins, it's called, and his name, I'm about to say it, After the Ruins. Well, Kim will look it up for me. But that book has, he is actually a geographer, and so he deals with the environment to some extent. And, you know, I think it would take a lot of work to do that, and I don't think anybody's done it. When I was writing the book, I talked to my colleagues here. We have a really active environmental studies program, and I mean, everybody knows what that means and what those objects are. But these are people who are real scientists. I talked to two different biologists, one of whom is an expert in aquatic toxicity and aquatic life and lakes and watersheds and whatnot, and the other of whom is actually a specialist in the kinds of diseases that get born through water and soil and whatnot. And so when I talked to them and just sat down and kind of went through this, both of them said that they wouldn't give any odds at all for that toxicity going away in 75 years or 80 years or 100 years, especially since the metals continue to degrade, especially since all the explosives, you know, about 20% of the these shells, these millions of shells fired in the front were duds. And so they'd be fired off and the fuse would go off and they didn't explode. And so the shell would just go ka-thunk into the ground. So those shells are still there. Now, many have been dug out and, you know, they continue to blow up just occasionally. But in any case, they the metal casing rusts and of the head of the shell, and that deteriorates, and then that those chemicals leak into the soil and made, you know, it's all nitrates and toluene and so forth. I mentioned to these two biologists the human bodies and just gave them some numbers of the corpses there and the air, you know, the corpses to area and human waste over that time. I mentioned this to them and both of them mentioned nitrates and the unnatural amounts of nitrates in the soil. So, yeah, but I do not know. That's a good thing. I need to, if I'm going to update this book and write a second version of it or something, then I really need to check that out. That's a good point. But so far, that's that little tiny little account is the only one I've seen. If anybody knows of a better account, please let me know, because I would like to. I would like to know, and I've just missed it if there's been one. Okay. Do you have any idea why the French were less racist and more accepting of blacks? Erica, I don't. I have a partial explanation, but I don't know the whys of that. In the empire at large, the French were always less uptight about racial things. In other words, in the history of, you know, the colonial conquest and so forth, the French always were more willing to mix with to marry, for example, American Indian women. The French couriers of the forest and all that stuff, they tended to marry in more than the English did. Same way in taking place in Africa, in Senegal, for example, the French were much more apt to mix and not be standoffish. And why that would be, I don't know. But that's the case. So there's a long history of it. And in the history of French colonial contact, it's also true that whereas the British always kept a kind of hands off, a real dividing line between themselves and whatever colonial peoples they let up into the administration, there was a kind of ceiling there and a clear division. The French didn't maintain such a thing. They tended to be more relaxed about letting people in and so forth. And then we get to the war itself, and from the very first, the war, the French, it's one long defensive emergency for the French, of course, because the Germans were on their soil the whole time. And they called up every single resource. We talked about these imperial units. So immediately, it didn't take any time before they had Algerian Muslims and black Senegalese on the Western Front, and people from different parts of the colonial empire. So, for some reason. And in fact, you know, this is funny that this comes up. I was just reading an account in a paper today. I did a research paper. It's the end of our semester, and I'm working on grading the research papers. And in a very good paper on Indian troops in the World War, he quoted a source, quite a long quote, where an Indian, North Indian, a Punjabi Indian, says, you know, the interesting thing is that these French women are so pleasant to us and treat us so well. We were really surprised that all the French, but especially these women, are kind to us. And I mean, he wasn't talking about this in any salacious way. He was just saying that people would come out and give them food and put their arm around their shoulder and pat them on the back and say, thanks, you know, for coming to defend France or whatever. And so that's of interest, too. So I can certainly see why these things happen. And I think that the you know, considering the treatment they got in Houston, I think that these black regiments probably enjoyed that same kind of experience as well. Leslie asks, do you think American troops would have made a difference if they had been put under Haig and Lloyd George? Well, I mean, they would have made a difference, but things would have veered in some other way. I mean, certainly the British wanted to, they knew they were financially behind, but they thought they could kind of direct the American war effort. And I have to say, I think in the Second World War, they actually succeeded in doing so, at least to a very large extent. Because at the first of the war, similar kind of thing. And in this case, it was George Marshall who went over and talked to the British. We know this from the account of Albert C. Wiedemeyer, who went with him. And the British just kind of talked the Americans out of everything. They didn't integrate the units, but they did talk the Americans into attacking in North Africa, which was really just simply something to help the British out. It wasn't to defeat the Germans. It was to get them out of a bind in a local area. So they were very much more clever. I think it would have been different, but, you know, for all the bad things that happened because of in this war, at least Pershing, and apparently on his own, in German, Auf eigene Faust, just on his own initiative, told these guys, and they were furious. Haig's diaries are full of invective against Pershing and what a mule he is and how stubborn. And Ferdinand Foch, the French chief of staff, was furious that anybody would talk to the French this way, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, Pershing just said, well, tough. So he was an interesting and a formidable character. I mean, I think he was a good soldier, and I think he was he was an agent of the state, that's for sure. But I mean, insofar as there was a state, there were agents of it. I think he was an upright person doing what he thought was right. Laura asks, it might seem too early to ask this, but it's something I was thinking about. How did the disruption of World War I affect the military strategies of World War II? Are there mentions of soldiers in that later war stepping on unexploded mines, falling into old trenches, etc.? Your book mentions that unexploded artillery, open trenches, etc. became important during the reconstruction effort and even affects things today. For example, in some areas of France, cannot support human living due to heavy metals in the soil. So I'm wondering about that later war, its military movements in France. Yeah, there are some that were crisscrossed, but not that many. In other words, it just worked out that they were fighting in different areas. They do intersect, but they were mostly in places that had been kind of reconstructed. So in that sense, they didn't have much of an impact. Also, in the Second World War, there's a little bit more motorization, and so, you know, I don't know of anybody exploding on a shell, but I mean, I wouldn't swear that it didn't happen, but I've never heard of that in World War II, so that's very interesting. Let me see if there's another part of that question in the beginning. I think that's it. I don't know... Laura, if that ever happened, I haven't heard it. But and you know, some of these shells. The interesting thing is, if you go along the Western Front today, in other words, if you just go over right now and fly over, take a trip down the front, and drive around in these areas, like along in the Somme, you drive down into the valley of the Somme River and drive again back up and where the attack took place, every field you see will have some shells lined up by it because it's what they call the iron harvest. It just comes up every season. You know, it works its the way rocks work their way up because of just the natural processes. Those shells work their ways up too, and the farmers plow them up. It does give you pause to think that they're plowing up potentially live shells. But anyway, that certainly happens. But I think I don't know of any military things that happen. Cam, thank you. Hugh Clout, After the Ruins, Restoring the Countryside. He's like describing FEMA in its infancy. who says this? Cam says the French are less uptight about everything. Well, not everything, but 90% of things. From Carl Fielding, the French baptized their black slaves and mixed with black colonists. The Brits didn't mix and didn't bother with baptizing their slaves. For Brits, the mixing was a social faux pas. That's exactly right. Yeah. So, and what the reason, Carl? I don't know if do we know a reason for this? I think that's exactly right. Cam said that's what my family did. The French and Irish marring the natives in southeastern Kentucky got plenty of meat. So the French, you're saying the French were so broad-minded they would even marry an Irishman? That's amazing. As being part Irish, I find that an amazing and wonderful thing. The University of Kentucky did a DNA test on many of my family in Kentucky, Cam says, and found sub-Saharan Africans are in lines. Wow. Okay. So, in Kentucky, are you saying, Cam, that it wasn't just the French who didn't hesitate to marry the Irishman, but it was also the African contingent that didn't hesitate to marry the Irishman? Okay. Very good. So, I'm kind of making a joke there. Okay. So, let's see what we got. I checked the bottom part, and I don't see any more questions. Is it that late? Is it really 9:09? This is so fun for me that I'm having a great time, and time passes quickly. Do you have any more questions? Because I'd be glad to. It's 9:09. It's 10:09 somewhere. Where is that, Kim? Is that in Indiana? Okay. So, if it's 9:09 in Indiana, I guess we should stop because, as I understand it, in Indiana they go to bed at 10:09. They go to bed about 10:15. So, but Kim is up all the time. He never sleeps. So, anyway, let's. If there are no more questions, I'm just talking to hear my head rattle here and wait for another question to come up. If there are no more questions, let's call it a night. And, Cam says coffee time, and there you have it. So we're done for another night. We have one more session. We're going to talk about the end of the war, some of these final effects. We're going to talk about the peace conference, and that it may be hard for me to stop talking about all that. But anyway... great to see you all tonight, and I will see you next time. Enjoyed it, everybody. Thanks for the great questions, and see you for one more shot. We'll be home by Christmas. All right. Good night.